This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey friends, we've got a great episode lined up here for you today. Sean Morgan, frontman, guitarist, and lead vocalist for the South African-based rock band Seether, stopped by to break down the writing, recording, and release of their smash hit Remedy, taken from the 2005 album Karma and Effect. Sean spoke of being a young artist struggling with who he was as a songwriter, amongst managers, producers, A&R people, and label executives, all telling him what they thought his music should sound like. He broke it all down in a super interesting and most humble way, and how this all fed into the inspiration behind this particular track. He mentioned that he didn't know everything during this time period, something that a lot of younger people have a hard time admitting, and entrusted producer Bob Marlette with guiding him through the process. A hefty payoff ensued, as this tune remained the number one song for 8 weeks straight on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. For all this, a hilarious story about a record producer who let everyone know they were beneath him, and a whole lot more, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Sean, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks, man. How are you doing? Bit of a slow start, but I feel like I'm here now. I'm present.
You are present. Found out that Sean is over in the Nashville, Tennessee area. I'm here in Knoxville. I told him we should just, driven and met in the middle to do this thing.
I'm constantly surprised by how many people have moved to the Tennessee area. Nashville's obviously exploding, which is more than I was happy with. I've been here for 8 years now. And even in that 8 years, I've seen just this massive influx of people coming in, especially a lot of musicians from LA that used to live out there that have moved in here. So it's a big community building, and it's no longer just country, you know what I mean? It used to be just like, it was known as like the country music city, and I'm sure you know that, but man, there's a lot of rock and metal guys here now.
Yeah, the drummer of my band lives in Nashville, and what I've seen happen there in the last 20 years is remarkable. I think Knoxville's next. There's a lot of stuff going on downtown with building and whatnot, but
yeah.
I want to give a little bit of a background for the listeners right now for Seether. They're a South African-based rock band founded in 1999. The band performed, this kills me by the way, Sean, the band performed under the name Sarin Gas until 2002, when they moved to the U.S. and changed it to Seether to avoid confusion with the deadly chemical known right. as Sarin Gas. And something, I've made it through like 80 episodes now, Sean. I've prided myself on never asking a band's what the band's name comes from, because I think that's the laziest ever question you could ask. In this case, though, Wikipedia, which you can't always believe, says the name came from the popular 90s song by Veruca Salt, Seether. Is that correct?
Yeah, because when we had Sarin Gas was picked out of a hat. Basically, we were doing demos, and we had a sound effect CD, and there was a bunch of weird titles and words, so we just picked our five or six favorites, threw them in a hat, and drew out Sarin Gas, and that's what we went with. We had no idea at the time that it was in any way, some sort of toxic gas or whatever. We just thought it was funny, and I believe at the time, Sarin meant something to do with like spiritual love or something in a different language. And this is what we were told. So we just ran with it. We thought we were really deep and really cool. And then we moved to this, we got the deal with Wind Up Records in, I think it was like September, July of 2000. Yeah, July of 2001, actually. And they said, look, the band's great and everything, but we've got to change the name. And we said, fine, okay. I mean, we will kind of treat this as a brand new step, a new chapter in the band, and, turn a new page. And so then it was the thing of, it's tough enough to come up with a band name the first time. That's kind of cool. You're like, yeah, this is great. And you finally settle on something. And so this time we were like, yeah, God. And for some reason, I really wanted a word with an S or a phrase with an S. And so we had, we went through a couple different variations. Stonefly was one option. And I was like, man, that's terrible. But that's because Dale's he's a fisherman. So, these stonefly nymphs are a thing that they fly fish with. So he was kind of into that. And at first I thought it was cool because Soulfly was a thing. So I was like, well, we can kind of fit into that fly category. But yeah, when we had to pick a name, I basically just said, well, you know, I was bored and I was listening to old CDs of bands that I liked. And I always really, really liked the grunge girl bands like L7, Veruca Salt, Babes in Toyland, all those kinds of bands.
Yeah.
And so I was listening to Veruca Salt. I was like, oh, dude, Seether's a great name. And because at the time I thought it was really funny and I didn't think anybody else would know. But there was another rumor that was swirling around it is that when they were singing the song, they were singing about their vaginas. And I was kind of like, well, that's funny. So let's call ourselves Vagina. So that's kind of where it came from. But you know, it kind of tied in too with the idea that, you know, we were kind of an angry band and seething. And so, I mean, to me, it was kind of, it was cool either way. Because we didn't honestly think we'd be here this long. So we said, let's just throw out a fun name and do it for a couple of years and we'll go back home. So that's basically how we picked it.
Well, if we ever do a show together, I'm going to thank you from the stages. Give it up for Vagina tonight, all right?
I like it.
Sean, and I love Veruca Salt and I love Seether. I love that song. Sean is the frontman, vocalist, guitarist, and founding member of Seether. Their first album, Disclaimer, was released in August 2002. And that album had three singles, Fine Again, Driven Under, and Gasoline. Fine Again achieved significant success and was also featured on Madden 2003. The band toured constantly, including a world tour with Evanescence. They reworked their acoustic ballad Broken to feature Evanescence lead singer Amy Lee. Seether's follow-up album Karma and Effect was released in May 2005. The album debuted at number 8 on the US Billboard 200. The album spawned three singles, Remedy, Truth, and The Gift. And of course, we're going to be breaking down Remedy today, which reached number 1 on the US mainstream rock charts. And it was their first number 1 hit with, at this point, 2021, 58 million YouTube plays. Congratulations on that success.
Thanks, man. Yeah, the YouTube stuff is so weird to me that's become a thing, right? That's a metric for like band success. But I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
No, it's that 58 million plays is pretty awesome. The album Karma and Effect, this is also awesome, was produced by Bob Marlette. Now, Bob, his productions are unreal, and how he has been able to traverse from the 80s when he got into producing and writing, and he's an accomplished composer and keyboardist. He's unreal. But his production, writing, and mixing credits include David Lee Roth, Ozzy Osbourne, Alice Cooper, Rob Zombie, Sebastian Bach, Rob Halford, and Lynyrd Skynyrd. And then, of course, he became famous for producing hit records for post-grunge and alternative bands such as Saliva, Shinedown, Seether, and Filter. So his career has just been unbelievable. How did you meet Bob?
I think that was a record company thing. As most of the early producers were, when we first came over in 2002, we worked with Jay Baumgartner, who was basically the A&R guy at Wind Up Records' best buddy. So he was sending all of the bands that way. And it was kind of like every Wind Up band went to NRG. So it was us, Evanescence, Finger 11, I think Drowning Pool recorded there too. And we all kind of went through the Jay Baumgartner School of Production. And then the second one, they wanted to try Bob Marlette because I think Jay's studio had kind of taken a turn, because for a while the NRG was the spot in LA. You know, I don't know if you'd ever been there, but it was, you know, us as green kids going in, they were like, whoa, you mean somebody goes out and gets us a burrito if we get hungry? It's like, yeah, that's great. You know, it's like you feel so special, and you know, that's 9-layer bean dip. Yeah, dude. But that studio was kind of, you know, it was outfitted to the gills. So it was a nice experience. But I met up with Bob. I don't know how the introduction was made, but I think again it was a label thing. And you know, usually when you get given a producer, you kind of go through the catalog and you see if it gels with what you want to do, and you kind of listen to what they've done. And I liked what he had done. I mean, he certainly had a great catalog. So I went over to his house and we met up, and then we did some writing in his garage, little studio that he had set up. And that's basically where I wrote Remedy and a couple of other ones from that album. And we were living at the Oakwood in LA at the time, so it was a really kind of depressing time, because the Oakwood's not a fun place to live.
We like to refer to the Oakwoods as the joke woods, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's known by many names, man, but it's a, you know, so we were there, and you know, we recorded that album at Larrabee, and I think we did the drums at A&M, and then we did the rest of the stuff at Larrabee, I think North, which is I think the one in the valley. And we could walk from the Oakwood to the studio every day. So it was kind of cool. And he was definitely an easy guy to work with. He definitely knows a lot about composing. He has a lot of ideas musically.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, that was a long time ago. And then we actually did part of that album too. We did it in New York at one of those really famous studios, mostly used by rappers. I forget what it's called now. But it was, you know, so it was like, it was this really sort of disjointed process. I wrote some stuff at Bob's Garage, did some stuff at A&M, did some stuff at Larrabee, and then did some stuff in New York too. So it was kind of all over the place, but it was a cool experience. He's, again, he's easygoing. He's got a pretty good work ethic as far as, You know, producers, they like to start at noon. And Bob, I think, was kind of a noon guy. But we'd go till about 8 or 9 at night. You know, a lot of guys were like, oh, wait, 6 p.m., let's go, you know, call it a day.
Yeah.
So it was nice to have longer days. And, you know, these days when we do albums, we start at 9 a.m. and we go till 10 p.m. So we try and get as much of a day in as possible for many reasons. One being, you know, once you start working, you want to get the ball rolling and you want to keep going. And the other being, you know, you want to have less days in studio, because it's like the days of record companies saying, yeah, sure, go spend $500,000 on making this album. Those are long gone. And thankfully, technology has progressed to the point that I can make most of the album in this room that I'm sitting in. But yeah, he was good, man. He was fun to work with.
Well, the reason I brought Bob up, you know, when my producer, Chris, he had been talking to your publicist, and Chris hit me up, and as he always does weekly, and says, hey, what do you think about Seether? I said, heck yeah. You know, and he said, well, what song? We started researching, you know, thought we'd do Remedy. And man, this production does not sound dated at all. I mean, I was thinking in my head, oh, this probably came out 2012 to 2015. I was shocked that this song came out in 2005. You know, it still sounds big and current, and that's really cool. And much like some of Bob's other productions, I think his production is great. The band Seether released 5 more albums since the release of Carmen Effect. Finding Beauty in Negative Spaces in 2007, Holding On to Strings, Better Left to Fray in 2011, Isolate and Medicate in 2014, Poison the Parish in 2017, and your latest, and I'm going to take a stab at this, see if I could pronounce it, Civis Pacem Parabellum in 2020?
That's not bad, yeah. It's Civis Pacem Parabellum.
What the heck does that mean? That's another podcast, right?
That's a lot closer than I've had so many DJs tell me, like, look, dude, did you have something against us that we have to say? We don't know what we're saying. I was like, just shorten it, do Parabellum. It just means if you want peace, prepare for war. When I was looking for the title for the album, this was sort of end of 2019, beginning of 2020, before everything ground down to a halt. And I just felt that it made sense for me as far as the lyrical content of the music and basically a lot of the music itself. I just felt like this was a good way to sum up everything I was trying to say. And then, you know, then everything shut down and it kind of was like, oh wow, this is starting to sort of feel like it applies a little bit more. And I don't know, just as the year and a half has gone by, it just feels like that the title was in some way, for me, probably the most meaningful one we've had in a while, just because it wasn't meant to mean very much. It was just supposed to be sort of like a snapshot in time. And now it seems like that snapshot has become a lot longer than it originally was supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, in the 40 years of the Billboard mainstream rock artist charts, Seether is number 8 of all time. On October 15th of this year, they released Vicennial, 2 Decades of Seether, which was a career-spanning compilation of the band's greatest hits. So number 8, man, that's impressive. Congratulations. Thanks, again.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's those are fun things to see. It's not something I put much stock in, but it's nice to be up there because, you know, it's something cool. You can hang on the wall one day and my kid will think I'm awesome because I was in the top 10. I was like, oh, wow, Dad was number 8. That's great. I don't know how old your kid is, but mine's only 4 right now, and she's very difficult to impress. And I feel like the older she gets, that'll only get more difficult. So
mine's 4 as well. We're right there.
That's awesome.
But yeah, and thanks for being humble. And I only say this and I congratulate you because that is impressive. It's something you should be proud of.
Thank you.
But we're going to jump into the song now. Remedy is 3 minutes and 31 seconds. And I just want to start by asking you, do you remember writing the song?
I think at the time I probably had about 5 or 6 songs that were done. And obviously you want to have anything from 12 to 15 before you go into record, so you can have something to sort of pare it down to an album length. So I just started tooling around. That guitar that I played it on was actually a John 5 baritone Tele, which back then was a brand new thing. And I was like, he's like, check out this guitar, my friend John 5. I was like, cool.
You know?
So I started playing on it and I was like, man, this thing sounds amazing. So I think I plugged right into his computer and just started messing around with riffs and everything. And then I came up with a riff and I was sitting there and he's like, oh, that's great. Let's work with that. So I started, you know, kept playing it. And then there was the first time I'd ever seen anybody do really well-programmed drums. Like I had, on our first album, when we did demos, we had a guy program the drums for us while we were gone during the week. And then we'd come on a Friday night and we'd do 2 or 3 tracks we'd pay him in McDonald's and then we'd leave and then we'd have this sort of, you know, MIDI drum thing, but with us playing guitar and stuff on. So I'd never seen it done before. So I was the first time I was blown away by, wow, these drums sound pretty killer for you just tapping away on your keyboard. And I think it's because of all the years of samples that he'd collected. So he had all these great snare sounds and kick sounds. Anyway, so it made the experience a lot more fun because I'm like, well, this sounds like a real drummer playing, so let me just keep going. So just ran with the song and basically wrote it, you know, in about 10, 15, 20 minutes as far as the music goes. And then I think went back a few days later with vocals and lyrics. And that's basically, it was just done in his little garage studio. And I think that for me, though, sometimes the less you think about a song and the more organically it sort of just arrives.
Yeah.
You know, you're just playing and you, because sometimes I'll sit up here and I'm like, oh, I've got to work. I've got to do something because I haven't done something for days. So if you're not inspired, you just sit here and you can play guitar for like 2 hours and literally go, man, I got nothing. Other days I'll come up here and I'll have, you know, 3, 4, 5 ideas will come out and I can get a pretty good idea of where I'm going with him. And that was just one of those times where it was, I don't remember what else I wrote in that space of his, but that was one of them that I specifically remember because it's one of those where it's like, wow, this riff, I don't even know where it came from. It's like, I don't know whether it was the just me messing around and him going, yeah, that's cool. And then being inspired by these really big killer drum sounds. But it really, yeah, it came together pretty quickly and quite organically. So I was happy with it. I figured it was kind of the sort of riffy, but also melodic kind of song that I wanted to write for the band. So at the time, it was pretty exciting because it was a new way for me to work. I'd always mostly written by myself like I do now. But, you know, that's only our second album. So we were still so young, man. We still didn't know what was going on. We still didn't know what we were doing. I barely knew how to run GarageBand, and I think it had just come out. So it was this brand new program. I'm like, oh, wow, this is cool. Let me get digital then. Because up until that point, I was still using tape cassettes and sort of, you know, playing, recording on a tape cassette, then either playing another tape next to it and then, you know, doing that sort of overdub thing. Or I was just keeping those single tapes going, and I would try and come up with a song and try and record an acoustic version of the entire song onto a tape cassette so I would have it. So for me, and this
the old recording struggle was real, man.
Right, man. It's like, so it was honestly, now that I think back to it, it was almost 20 years ago. I think it was like 2003, end of that, maybe 2004. And it was kind of weird seeing all this stuff work like that, because I, you know, for it felt to me like we'd hit the big time, because even in South Africa, when we recorded some stuff in a studio, it was all analog. There was not really much that was done on computers. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it was a pretty cool experience.
That's cool. Well, this song is super fun to play, and I may have to write some more songs in drop D. This song's in drop D flat tuning. It's basically the main riff of the song is just barring with one finger, and the older I get, these arthritis in my thumbs isn't so good. So
yeah,
barring full chords with all my fingers, I might have to take a bite out of this. But man, this riff is so fun to play. I kind of figured out last night. It's really cool. Feedback starts off immediately. This feedback comes in immediately. The main riff of the song starts that I was just talking about by itself for 7 seconds. At the 8 second mark, there's a straightforward but powerful cracka cracka. I put in my notes, which is the snare drum and the kick that comes in and the full band's in. It's just a big, thick, heavy sound. From 15 seconds to 21 seconds, that's when the guitar lead comes in, which again is super fun to play this riff. It took me a minute. There's some cool string bends in there that happen. And that leads us up to the 21 second mark, and we're into the first verse. So up to this point, the original demo and when you were writing the song with Bob, was it pretty much the same or was there any changes?
Yeah, no, it was pretty much what it was. That solo is what it is because at the time, you know, we were a 3-piece band, so we didn't have a lead guitarist. And so really a lot of the stuff I wrote was kind of more along the lines of the new metal type stuff where they would have, you know, the bridges would be more sort of like a riffy breakdown type of thing. And maybe a vocal rather than a solo because I didn't have time to play them. And I honestly wasn't very good. So that solo I just played because I was like, well, I like this bend. It sounds pretty ugly, but at the same time, it's got melody. So I kind of ran with it.
Ugly is a good word. It's a dirty solo. It sounds mean.
Well, the feedback ties into that too. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of producers do not like feedback at all. When they produce, they want it to be clean and crisp and glossy and shiny. And
they'll gate all that out.
Yeah, of course. You know, just compress it all to this big fat flat line. But I've always really enjoyed that side of music. You know, I was inspired by Nirvana. I was inspired by Pearl Jam when I was a kid, and I really got into Rage Against the Machine as I got older. But I always, for me as well, when I would watch live performances, I loved the sort of the chaos of trying to rein in feedback that's constantly trying to get out of the gate, right? So it's like, I never had a noise gate for the first, I don't know, 5, 6, maybe 10 years of playing live. So I always controlled the noise with my on and off switch on my channel. And then I got a noise gate, so I wouldn't have to do that. I would have a different device to do it. But it's always been a really big part of the show. And even today in the newest stuff, we use a lot of we use feedback where I think it makes sense, as far as if you're playing and the guitar feeds between, like in a stop, I think it's cool to keep it there, because if you tidy it up and clean it up too much, I think it becomes a little sterile. But yeah, so that was it. It was start with a feedback, sort of set a tone, and then have that big drum fill just enter. The riff's great, I think, and then you have that sort of ugly melody, sort of bendy thing, which I think all kind of set the tone for the rest of the song. So it was all about building, because someone told me years ago, it was like, you want to have the kind of song that as soon as it starts, everyone knows exactly what song it is, right? They want to know, oh, this is that song. And there's no waiting around like, oh, is this what I think it is? Or there's no question as to, okay, this is the song I want to hear, and this is the song that's playing now, so let me crank up the volume. And that was kind of, I think, a subconscious idea behind the intro was to make it one of those songs that is instantly recognizable. And even today still, we end pretty much most of our sets with that song, because it's the one that people love to really see live. It's one of the bigger ones, and it's a good way to end the set, because you kind of put that big old full stop on it and say, thank you so much for coming out, here's that song that we wrote, you know, 18 yeah. odd years ago.
And I bet you played those European festivals where people are actually singing, the whole crowd singing that guitar riff.
Yeah.
Which yeah. that blows my mind when you hear the crowd sing the guitar riff. It's like, wait, you're supposed to be singing the lyric. Yeah. It's so cool. But that riff, it's all the pull-offs, mm-hmm. the in-betweens, you know, that's what makes that riff, and it's really awesome. At the 21-second mark, we're in the first verse.
Throw your dollar bills and leave your thrills all here with me. And speak but don't pretend, I won't defend you anymore, you see. It aches in every bone, I'll die.
Throw your dollar bills and leave your thrills all here with me. Mm-hmm. And speak, but don't pretend, I won't defend you anymore, you see. It aches in every bone, I'll die alone, but not for you. My eyes don't need to see that ugly thing, I know it's me you fear. What's going on here?
Well, if I listen to back to you saying it, I never really back then would take too much time to think about lyrics. I would really just do more of a subconscious stream of thought process and just write stuff as I was going. So I'm assuming, and I could look it up, as I would have the original demo somewhere, but even the original demo would have some sort of placeholder melody with sort of just with cadence, so I would know what I would want to hear at the end. So when it came to actually recording a lot of these songs, and actually most of them through my career, I would wait until right before going into the studio to do the vocal, and then I would sit and write the lyrics out, knowing in my head, okay, this is how I want it to, you know, this is how I want it to gallop along the line. This is the melody line I'm using, and now I've got to fit this all in and have it all make sense. And I think at the time, we'd had such a bad experience with the A&R guy at Wind Up Records, because he was kind of a prick, as I think a lot of them are, especially when you don't understand.
I was gonna say, an A&R guy be a prick? You're well, kidding, yeah. right, Sean?
Thankfully, these days we have an amazing A&R guy. But back then, we dealt with him, and then the one after him was even worse, I'd say. But anyway, I think he inspired a lot of that, because he kind of went out of his way, and then the subsequent guy after him as well kind of went out of both of their ways to say, hey, you know, you suck at this. You need to let me or one of my friends come in and write for you, because we know what we are doing. And then, you know, and basically they all want to dip into the publishing. And if I listen to a lot of that now, there's definitely reference to me feeling a lot like a product, understanding the dynamic between label and band is not a friendship, and it may come across that way, but it's never a friendship. It's always a let's go to dinner, but it's
a business.
And then they sign your name on the back, and then you have to pay them back, right? You have to pay every cent back. And I think a lot of that was just really me feeling out where we fit in the world. And it's I mean, and that could apply to relationships and things too. But I think because for me, still being so young, I think at the time I was about 24, maybe 25, and still kind of trying to figure out my way in this business and still like going, wow, well, we're still here. That's great. So let's just keep writing. So there's a lot of inspirations drawn from it. But I think on any given day, you can say, okay, that was about this person or this thing or that situation. And then some other day, I'd be like, oh, well, maybe it was about that. But it seems to me when you say it that way, it was kind of, you know, I think even that first line in some way at the time would have meant, you know, they throw money at something, but they don't really believe in it, because why would you sign a band, right? You sign a band from South Africa, you fly them over, you relocate them, and then you spend the rest of your time trying to change what they sound like and what, you know, who they are, right? It's like, you will add a touring guitarist, you will do this, you will change that. And you go, well, then why don't you...
I thought you like me, honey. Why don't you want to wear this different dress?
Exactly. Why don't you go find that band and then do whatever you want to do with them? But, you know, it takes years and album after album before you start realizing you can push back.
That's interesting. And you're not the first person that has brought up a lyric on this show that it was dealing with some of the turmoil and confusion of what was going on with their relationship with the A&R guy, the producer, yeah, the label. That's interesting that you know, because reading this verbatim, it almost like to me, there's a number of things this could mean, but the fact that it was kind of a stream of consciousness that you were just kind of throwing down and being able to reflect down and go, you know what, it may have been about all this. That's neat.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, there's definitely elements of it in there, because it was such a, those were the most important people in my life at the time. As far as, you know, I'd been married and divorced already. So I was just this guy trying to figure out where I fit in the world. And the people at the label, they smell fear and they sense weakness very quickly. So they'll put their thumb on that bruise as fast as they can. And that's kind of what it was, that you always felt like you were walking around on eggshells with labels, because they always make you feel like crap about yourself. You know, and again, now we are at a label where it's the complete opposite of that. But I spent the first 15 years of my career being told how much I suck. So there's a lot of songs, I think, where subconsciously that kind of crept in, you know?
Hey, everybody, don't you dare go anywhere. There's lots more Chris to Makes a Podcast after these messages from our sponsors.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock. DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
If you're looking for an inexpensive and unique gift for a friend, family member, or even for yourself, check out iloveenamelpins.com. From Hollywood stars like Jeff Goldblum and Meryl Streep, to fictional characters like the Golden Girls or Jack Torrance, to sports stars and musicians and politicians and dogs and cats, there's something for everyone at iloveenamelpins.com. As an added bonus, use the discount code CHRISTAMAKES at checkout to save 30% off your order at iloveenamelpins.com. And now, back to the show.
When the verse comes in, there's like this tom drum breakdown with a cool string picking pattern on the clean guitar. And that's throughout the whole verse. About halfway through, when you get to the third line, it aches in every bone. Another chuggier guitar almost panned off to the left comes in right there. Kind of just, you know, just adds a little something. Are you singing? It aches in every bone. I'm tired alone, but not for you. I like that harmonies, and they're haunting harmonies in this song, come in on the very third, on the third and fourth lines here. And it goes all the way up to the fourth line. I know it's me. And then the last thing here, you say, you fear. There's no harmony on that. Do you remember, was that something that Bob was talking about in the studio wanting to do? Or was that something you wanted to leave a harmony off there?
I will say, after all the years of working with all these producers, Bob was a pretty good, a big fan of dynamic. And little things like that can make a big difference. Like, you know, to the average person, it might not make a huge difference, but he was kind of into the nuance of things. And whenever you did stuff like overdubs, he made you think about it in a way which I had never thought about, because when I was in a three-piece band, overdubs weren't important. And you know, the reason why we did a lot of stuff in drop D was because if I was playing just with my finger on the top three frets, I could add my ring and my pinky and really fill it up with, you know, with the sort of the D chord shape. So it could sound like there were two guys playing. But at this point in time, we had a member in the band called Pat Callahan. So there was writing the stuff, it was quite conscious that we were trying to include the second guitar part in that. Really, I think a lot of it was modeled off of, if you looked at the dynamics of Smells Like Teen Spirit, I think it follows quite closely to that sort of blueprint where you start off, with the exception of starting off clean, right? But we came right in, and then you have that soft, loud dynamic, because that's just something that as a kid, you know, listening to the Pixies, listening to Nirvana, Pearl Jam, all of those kinds of bands, it was just, to me, that was the stuff that I loved. It's like, when you hit a chorus, let's make it a chorus. Let's make it big.
Yeah,
let's make it loud.
Yeah.
You know, and really, really have a dynamic shift. So I think the harmonies, and for me, it's always been a thing too. And to this day, I still like to bring in a harmony around the third or the fourth line. And then depending on how you transition from the verse into the chorus, then you can sort of mess around with ideas there. And then, you know, for a while, the trend was you have to have a pre-chorus, right? So that became like, you have to have a change here. It has to die. And I was like, yo, that's cool. I can get into it. And we did that for a few years. We would have the prerequisite pre-chorus. And, you know, then it sort of became, that sort of felt a little hackneyed. But I think little things like that, like in this particular place, you know, you fear, it's just one small subconscious way to say, okay, there's a change coming, without doing a massive drum fill, or without doing, you know, like I said, again, the pre-chorus that you know, okay, well, this is the thing before the other thing happens.
Yeah, well, that's what I love so much about doing this podcast, is these nuances, and they fascinate me. Because I sit here and I go, why? That's why I always ask, well, who did that? Why was there? Because in this instance, it adds a little bit of, there's some personal thing going on with just saying you fear by yourself. It's not it's not the harmony on there. It's a little more personal, which leads into, at the 54-second mark, what I'm calling the pre-chorus, which, Sean, might be the shortest pre-chorus in history at 3 seconds. No, it's me, you. The line is, if you want me, hold me back. And on back, that is just Sean alone with a feedback guitar. And also on that line, the drums switch to a straight beat from that tom beat, which is in the verse. And the big stereo guitars come in. I say big stereo guitars because they're there. But then when the chorus hits, they get even bigger, which is awesome. But that's what I'm calling the pre-chorus. Would you consider that part of the verse or the pre-chorus?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably like a tag. I guess you could consider it a pre-chorus. It was, like you say, it was a short one. And it didn't quite follow the formula which came after that on a bunch of albums and with a bunch of bands, where you had to have, you know, like a 4-bar pre-chorus. At least we nipped it and kept it real short there. But I would say that's probably the pre-chorus. Yeah,
I like it because the guitars come in there. Okay, it gets heavy, but then it even gets heavier when the chorus comes in, and that's really that dynamic's cool. At 58 seconds now, we're in the in chorus number one. Thrill, the skin is dry and pale, the pain will never fail, and so we go back to the remedy. Clip the wings that get you high, just leave them where they lie, and tell yourself you'll be the death of me. Frail, the skin is dry and pale, the pain will never fail. And so we go back to the remedy. Clip the wings that get you high. Just leave them where they lie and tell yourself, you'll be the death of me. There's harmonies throughout this whole thing, except on line two. Back to the remedy, it almost sounds there like maybe the vocals are double tracked on the lead vocal and there's no harmony there. It was kind of hard to tell how it's mixed. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, on all the choruses, Bob was a big fan of, and still to this day, I like to double stuff in the choruses. So in most of the stuff we do, there's the main melody is always doubled, and often the harmony is doubled as well. Because when I'm doing demos, I like to do the main vocal just slightly panned left and right, and then I do the harmonies panned hard left and right, so that if you're listening in headphones, they kind of sit behind your head. You know what I mean? So it feels like you got this 360 situation going on. So that's definitely doubled. You know, and then that was something I never understood until I came to the States and understood that's how you get that really big full sound. It's not a particularly clever trick now that everyone knows about it, but I think it's so effective because it does create, it's sort of like you say, the chorus gets bigger, not only with the vocals because they're getting doubled, but the guitars then also got doubled. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
You've got all of this stuff, and it's the old the guitorchestra, right? It's like where you have to have the riff and then the double of the riff on this side, and then the riff on this side, and then the double of it on the right hand side, and then just in case you throw one down the middle just if he's feeling saucy. And then oftentimes, even sometimes, we would do a subsonic riff that was the same riff, but it was tuned a whole step down. So and that sort of came later for us, but it's a trick to make it feel bigger and sort of fill the gaps that are there in the verse. And I think it's effective, especially if you're listening in headphones or if you're listening on speakers too, because that's my favorite, is to sit up here and crank stuff loud enough that the neighbors complain. But yeah, it's a nice way to sort of elevate it without bringing too much extra noise and sound into it. You just really sort of, just by doubling or sometimes tripling the tracks, you can create this huge sort of wall of sound. And in those days, when we were recording with Jay and with Bob, and even when we did with Brendan O'Brien, there was no tracking, you know, your three guitars at the same time. It was, you would track each one separately. So it's like, okay, well, let's do Marshall, and you do the Marshall, then you do the Mesa, then you do the Bogner. So you go, okay, cool, now we've got those three. Then you go, now we have to do the other side. So there was never anything like where today we'll do Bogner, Mesa, and Kemper, and we'll do a clean line just to have four that we can then say, okay, cool, what does this need to blend everything together? So it took a lot longer back then, because you literally can play one song the entire day because you've got to do, you know, 8, 9, 10 parts. That's kind of the idea, was just to make it sound bigger by doubling the vocal as well.
Yeah, no, and you can hear all those stacks, or the vocal stacks and the musical stacks. It's awesome. And this chorus is catchy as hell. And, you know, you touched on Nirvana. You know, Kurt double-tracked all his choruses, or a lot of them. Definitely Teen Spirit and some of those songs. And this chorus, man, I'm telling you, this chorus sounds like it could have been off something off In Utero. It just reminds me of that period of Nirvana. It's just
thanks, man.
Really catchy and really cool. And you can tell that you were a big fan.
I was very much inspired as a kid. I mean, Kurt inspired me to pick up guitar and learn to play guitar. First song I ever learned was Polly. Isn't me, haven't seen, let me clap, dirty wings, let me take a ride, cut yourself, want some help, please myself. And Nevermind was a very, very influential album to me when I was about 12 years old or 13 years old. So it certainly was back then. And this, you know, this was that album we recorded probably about 10 or 11 years after that. So I was still very, very heavily influenced by the Nirvana dynamics. It's funny, if I listen back to some of the Nirvana stuff now, the guitars were not as heavy as I remember them as a kid. They're actually not that heavy at all, which is interesting because the heaviness came from the combination of everything, you know, Grohl's drums and the bass and the guitars. So because he's got like an overdriven single coil, you know, Strat sound basically, and these days it's, everyone's got humbuckers and you've got your massive tube amps rocking. It's crazy how in my head I would hear, you know, something off of Nevermind being so big and so loud and so heavy. And if I go back now, it's actually far more nuanced than that, which is interesting. And there's no overdubs, you know what I mean? In the chorus, it's just the guitar. There's no like fiddly bits at the top of the, you know, it's the meat and potatoes of the song and the vocals. And I really find it interesting that in today's music, it's almost like it's expected that there's a lot more going on than just the fundamentals of the song, right? So even in Remedy, there's not a lot of overdubbing There's no fiddly stuff in the chorus. It's just the riff and the vocal, basically.
I want to comment on that. That's a great point for the listeners. When he's talking about fiddly stuff, you're talking about little noodly guitar parts panned off to the right speaker or to the left, or this little counter melody that's going on. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. I love that it comes out of the chorus straight and breaks back down to that Tom drum breakdown with that clean guitar picking. Be the devil, man. I don't need a frown. I need to mount so far. Lyric is, I don't need a friend, I need to mend so far away. So come sit by the fire and play a while, but you can't stay too long. It aches in every bone. I'll die alone, but not for pleasure. I see my heart explode. It's been eroded by the weather here. I love this. On the back half, lines 3 and 4, it aches in every bone. I'll die alone, but not for pleasure. I see my heart explode. It's been eroded by the weather here. The third and half of the fourth line, there's harmonies.
Yeah.
But whereas there was only two words not harmonized in verse one, this whole line, it's been eroded by the weather here. There's no harmony. It's just you alone. Again, was that something that Bob said, let's lay off that? Or did you have a harmony there that when he went to mix it, it just didn't make the record? Or how'd that happen? Do you recall?
Yeah, no, that would have been definitely a Bob call, because, again, we were still very much in awe of the process and didn't really have too much input creatively back then even. It's funny to say, but in the early days of being a band, there's some bands that come out and say, no, this is how we want to do it, and they get away with it, and it's great. But it was our experience that whenever we sort of pushed back against the producer, they would be very resistant against it, because they wanted it to be their product, right? It's not your album, it's their album, and they know what's best for their album as opposed to you knowing what's best for yours.
Did you ever hear this one, Sean? How many hit records do you have on the wall?
Right. Dude, we had a guy that went as far as, when you walked into his recording studio, on the door, as you walk in, there was the number of albums he'd sold that week across all of the bands that he'd recorded. I was like, God, as if we don't know, but now there's a daily reminder of the updated sales. So there's guys out there that'll definitely throw it at you.
Can't get much more intimidating than that.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I called that pre-chorus one before, Sean, is because, again, it comes back. If you want me, hold me back for 3 seconds. If you want me, hold me back, thrill. I did notice here, and I think it's cool, because it's not cookie cutter and paste, which I'm assuming this record was done in Pro Tools.
Yeah, it was definitely Pro Tools.
Right. So a lot of times with Pro Tools, we can just fly parts from the first chorus to the second chorus. The feedback is different here.
We basically played it from start to finish, because that was kind of what the approach was for us. Is what we wanted to do was have it be as organic as possible and not do any kind of flying around. Like, in some sense, back then we were kind of treating it as the purest experience, because we wanted to prove that we could actually play. And so we approached everything by playing it from, if we could play it all the way through, that's how we would record it. Otherwise, we would punch in or whatever, but we definitely liked to play as the song rolled on. That's why you would have variations in feedbacks and variations in guitar accents. And it was, because you never really want to repeat that. Because I think it might, again, not be that obvious to the untrained ear, but I think people that know what they're listening to will go, oh, hang on, they just flew that. And I think you can get away with that sometimes. But for this, we really wanted it to have its own dynamic every time and not be something that sounded clearly like it had been flown around because of just trying to save time,
Right. And I've talked about that on the show before, where you can just get a good first take of a chorus and just move it over to chorus two with the click of a mouse. And that wasn't done here. And I think that's refreshing and that's cool. The 1 minute and 46 second mark, there's a double chorus now. Thrill, the skin is dry and pale. The pain will never fail. And so we go back to the remedy. And basically, this is just the first chorus. It's doubled. You know, there's quite a few lyrics here. It's not like you're saying Remedy over and over right. again as one word or one refrain. And the double chorus here, was there ever any other lyrics like for the second half, or did you always want it to be the same thing, same lyric twice?
You know, I thought about changing it. I've often had songs where I would have a chorus where it doubles, but it stays the same. But or I'll try and get clever and write some new lyrics for the second half. But if it doesn't beat the first half, then I'd rather just repeat it. You know what I mean? And then sort of and repeat the sentiment of the lyrics. Because for me, it's a game of if you say one thing, you got to, and if you're gonna double up, you need to sort of push the idea or the emotion. You have to elevate that slightly, and then ultimately in the bridge, you want to elevate the entire thing and bring it all together, and then sort of finish off with it, with the chorus again.
Also, what I was saying too is I think there's enough information here. Yeah. You know, if yeah. you're gonna if you're gonna do a double chorus, the back half of it's got to be at least as strong or stronger than what you said before.
Right, right.
And then you run the risk of losing the listener. You know, is it still hooky enough?
Yeah.
And I think that this warrants saying it twice. I think it's perfect.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Well, you know, I also learned from there was a woman, the producer that we worked with, the very first guy we worked with in South Africa. His ex-wife wrote music as well. And man, her lyric sheets were like novels. There was just so much. She never repeated anything. The choruses didn't repeat. There was like, she was just constantly putting, so if you hear the song, you hear the first chorus. By the time the second chorus comes along, you don't know what the lyrics are going to be. And she never repeated stuff. And I thought it was kind of cool in an artistic sense, but I just couldn't wrap my mind around because I want something to hold on to and sort of sing along to, right? And if you keep changing it on me, I feel like it's too much hard work to remember these lyrics. I mean, I have a hard enough time remembering my own words as it is. But yeah,
I can relate.
So I think in this sense, it was one of those things where it's like, don't overthink it. Let's do a double because it feels right to put it here. And then let's just repeat the chorus just because, like you said, I think enough was said that really when you do a double, you're sort of just trying to drive that point home. You know what I mean? You don't have to bring some other new idea or other thought in, especially because the whole thing is really dealing with the idea of, you know, drug and alcohol abuse, being driven to it and trying not to be driven to it and trying to get away from it all. So I think in that sense, it was really about driving, again, that point home of you know, this son of a bitch is making me miserable. So I'm trying to make this point and really get that across, you know?
Yeah. Well, at the 2 minute and 16 second mark, I love the departure that happens here. We're in the bridge and the guitars go to like a straight strumming pattern with new chords here. And this section, it doesn't sound like anything else in the song. Everything else is just kind of brooding and the staccato guitar parts.
Yeah.
And here it's kind of straight and it's a great departure here. I love the super low buried haunting backing vocals here. I think it's great.
Yeah.
And from 2 minutes and 31 seconds to 2 minutes and 37 seconds, for 6 seconds, you hold out the word in.
Yeah.
The lyric is, hold your eyes closed, take me in. Hold your eyes closed, take me in. And the last in, you hold out over the intro guitar riff. The intro guitar riff comes back in there. But the guitar is broken down to just one guitar. It kind of gets small there.
Yeah.
And then the guitars come back in with the band and the intro riff is still going. And that original lead part, that lick, that bendy lick that the intro riff, that comes back in, but it expounds on what it is in the intro. It kind of tails off from there and does a little bit more of a solo, which, again, it sounds dirty and mean.
Again, it's the limitations of my creativity at the time. It's like, hey, I can do this. Don't ask me to shred, man. I can certainly do these couple of notes. Sometimes for me, you can introduce an idea in the intro and then wait for it to come back. And it's something that brings that familiarity thing back in. So the whole idea of, having choruses have the same lyrics and occasionally changing them up in the second half of choruses and things. But for me, a lot of music, what makes it interesting is the familiarity of some emotional connection to the lyrics, and you like to hear them repeated because they mean something to you. And every time those lyrics are repeated, then you can sing them and you can yell them or whatever your response is. And I think that's true for most music, really. But that to bring that solo thing back in, I think it made sense just because I really liked the way it sounded in the beginning. And in the beginning, you get a short version of it. It's like a little, hey, how's it going? Check this out.
Right.
And then here it's more of an 8-bar or maybe it's 4, but whatever it is. But it's longer.
Yeah, it's like 2 measures, yeah.
So it's kind of more of the just really... And then, when it just sort of wails at the end, it almost sounds like something's in pain. It sounds like you're trying to create something, orally that sort of drives the point home too. So that bridge lyric, it's about feeling like I'm getting screwed over by the A&R guy and the record company and all that stuff. So it's really from the lyrical perspective is from their side to us. The solo thing at the end was kind of like to sort of expand on that idea of this what oftentimes with them would feel like a painful experience, and it was kind of not traumatic in any sense, but it was a tortuous experience because dealing with those people that got their heads so far up their own asses, it's like it's difficult to have conversations when somebody comes in and they from their perspective, their view and their opinion is the only right one in the room, and that never faltered. It was always when you write songs and you have ideas, it's like, nope, no, you're wrong. This is how it should go. And so I for me, a lot of the times, and again, more we dig into the song, which I've never done before, it's more and more about how I felt like we were just a product, and it didn't matter how we were, how our lives were going, what was going on mentally, what was in any sense going on. It was all about, you are our thing. You will do as you are told. And then you'll get on a bus and go tour for 2 years. You know what I mean?
Well, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, and it's refreshing and it's humbling again for you to say something like that, because most artists and bands that I've met over the years, and I've been doing this for a while, we all do this because we love music. We loved it since we were young. We're doing this for music first. It wasn't about money and fame and being in the magazines or on TV.
Right.
Okay. And here you are sitting there questioning all these suits around you, telling me how your songs need to be. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I've met very few people where I can go, you know what, that band's a sellout. We're all still cut from that cloth of like, hey, you know, like you said earlier, you signed my band. What's wrong with me now? You know? But that solo, it didn't need to be pretty. It had to be dirty, had to be what it was. I think it's great. The other thing I marvel at here, Sean, is from the 2:38 mark all the way. So basically for the last minute of the song up to 3:31, as we get into chorus number 3 at the 2:54 mark, but the last minute of the song basically is the chorus riff.
Yeah.
So you're coming out of this guitar solo.
Yeah.
And as I'm analyzing the song, I'm going, wait a second. It's the same riff.
Yeah.
How's this chorus going to feel like it got bigger? And it, because usually the bridge is a departure. You want it to be different chords going somewhere, which it does for the first half. But how is this chorus going to work? And somehow it does. Somehow it's, you don't do a key change or anything here, but the chorus seems like it lifts on chorus 3. That's very interesting. I've met very few songs that start off the chorus riff leading into the last chorus of the song. That's intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, I think again, it's one of those kinds of riffs, and the song is so short. You know, it's exactly what an A&R department wants at that 3:30, right? It's like if they can cut off a couple seconds here or there, they will. But I think it's just one of those things where, again, if you overthink it sometimes, you can do the song a disservice, right? It's like you can certainly go, all right, and we've done that. We've on subsequent albums with Brendan O'Brien, we would overthink some things, and he would make us do these weird chord changes, and it's like, okay, cool. And even sometimes, you'd go a step up for that last chorus after the bridge, and it's cool. It's not something I'm accustomed to writing. It's not how I write, but it was cool to sort of experience that and see, okay, cool. Yeah, that's one thing I don't necessarily like to do, but I'm going to try it this time and see if it works out.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, but on paper here, this shouldn't have worked.
Right.
This shouldn't have worked going into the third chorus.
Yeah, they should have.
you know, the third chorus shouldn't have lifted like it does. Usually, like, okay, here comes the chorus again. It's like, wait a second, we're in the same chords. How is this going to work? And it does in this song. There's some kind of genius going on here that I'm still trying to figure out after listening to it for, I mean, I've heard the song over the years, but really diving in the past couple of days and going, wait a second, how is this working? And it's great. You know, you get into chorus three at 2 minutes and 54 seconds. It's another double chorus.
Yeah.
Everything's basically the same here. Halfway through, though, when you get the double chorus, the drums go double time on the snare here. Kind of seems like there's some urgency. Yeah. You're leading up to something, which is the last line here. You say that last line without a harmony,
yeah,
which again is a very personal lyric. You'll be the death of me.
Yep.
And on the words death of me, the whole band dun dun dun.
Yeah.
And the song just ends. And tell yourself you'll be the death of me. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, it makes a pertinent statement. Was this kind of what it was like originally working with Bob in his garage, or was this something that you did in the studio, or was this kind of how it always was?
I would have to go back and look at the demo on that. Occasionally, even in the early days, and even now, occasionally we'll be in the studio and you'll call audibles and you'll go, no, let's try this there and let's change that up, and sort of really confuse the drummer for about 15 minutes while he figures out the ending.
They love that. Yeah. They love that.
They love change.
Yeah. I've been playing this for 6 months and you thought it was fine then.
Yeah. No. So I think... If I remember correctly, it probably just ended on a sustained note, which would be kind of par for the course for that time when we were writing. So I think that may have been a big sort of, you know, ring out note. But I think when we got into the studio, and once you have a lyric, if you have a lyric that sort of, you know, you'll be the death of me is kind of a great way to end the song. And it sort of really is the point of the song, right? It's like that's what I was trying to say. So to have it at the very end as the full stop at the end, and that to be the point, and then have it to be in such a vulnerable way without all of the other noise around it, I think it's pretty effective. I'm not sure if that was the original way it ended. And I'm actually, without having complete lyrics and a fleshed out idea, I'm fairly certain it wasn't. So that would have been an in the studio call saying, hey, well, let's, how about we do this ending instead and make it more of a, you know, drive the point home. Because you could say you'll be the death of me and have that note ringing, and it just wouldn't be as powerful, I don't think.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. I think it makes a statement.
Yeah.
I think it comes to a screeching halt. And I think the lyric warrants that. I think it's great.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to wrap up here in a moment. I just want to, first off, just again, congratulations on all your success. I want to thank you, man, for jumping in the hot seat with me today.
No, thanks for having me.
Very interesting to go through this song. And if you'd like to leave the listeners right now with anything you have going on, Seether has coming up, let us have it.
We have an EP coming out early next year, which is the third installment of Seaweed's Puck and Parabellum. We just released the Wasteland EP a couple months ago. And there's a third part, which is basically, it's the five remaining songs of the 21 originally recorded for the album. And then we couldn't figure out which ones we wanted on the album. But I knew we wanted them all to come out. So that's coming out. I have nothing but about 9 months of time on my hands right now, because there's no touring for us until probably July of next year, it seems. So I'm going to start working on the next Seether album. And then, you know, next year would be the 20th anniversary of Disclaimer. So we've got a whole bunch of things happening right now. So I don't know what the calendars look like and what's going on, but there's going to hopefully be a new Seether album. I mean, it depends on how the writing goes, but it could be as early as the end of next year or the very early part of 2023, I'd say. But yeah, there's a lot going on. It's funny, we did a short run of 3 months this year, and it was great to tour again, and it felt amazing. And now we're just back home again, sort of treading water, and it puts you right back where you felt before. You're like, okay, cool. So we'll just wait around until we get to do stuff again. So that's kind of where we're at. So instead of, you know, wallowing in self-pity this time, I'm going to turn all of that misery from 2020 and the first part of 21 into the next album for Seether. And who knows? I might start working on some solo stuff too. Again, I've got so much time on my hands and I've got so much sort of pent up creativity, because I didn't really do much for a whole year and a half. Because I honestly, it wasn't that I had any kind of creative break or anything. I just didn't feel like doing anything. I wanted to be as present a dad and a husband as I could be. And just try and be there as much as I could for my wife and my kid. And that was difficult, you know, because of the routine was like, okay, go 6:30 is bedtime, right? That's when we crack a cocktail, have a couple cocktails, go to bed at like 10, wake up at 6, you know, 6:30, you know, it's like hang out with a kid again, you know, so it was like this cycle. So I didn't really want to be away from that, because the blessing, the silver lining of the whole thing was I got to see my kid go from somebody that was sort of mumbling a couple of words to now being this really clever little stubborn,
sure,
little smart ass that she is. And it's so that was amazing. And I'm really glad that I got to have that, because if that hadn't happened, I would have been gone now for well over a year, you know, and only being home, yeah, sporadically. And that would have been way worse. So I could take, you know, I would rather take all that burden on myself and still be here. But yeah, so as far as Seether goes, that's what we're doing. New EP early next year, and then probably looking at new music within the next year and a half or so.
Well, that's beautiful. That's how I approach it. You look for the blessing, yeah, blessings within the disaster. So
absolutely.
Exactly. But man, best of luck to you and the guys. I appreciate you being on.
Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate you having me. It was awesome.
Hey, everybody. Don't touch that dial. There's plenty more Chris to Makes a Podcast after a few words from our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, do you have an idea for a podcast but don't know where to start? Or do you have an already existing podcast that you want to take to the next level? Well, check out WeKnowPodcasting.com. From concept development to theme music to editing to logos, WeKnowPodcasting.com is a one-stop shop for all things pod. Don't hesitate to hit us up. We're very nice.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song via MP3 only and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Truce, a four-piece hard rock band from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, consisting of Spencer Davis on guitar and vocals, Redmond Kang on lead guitar, Alex Lemieux on bass, and Daniel Mills on drums. Their debut album just came out on Halloween, and you can find all their music at linktree.com/trucemusic. Here's a snippet of their song, Home.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Well, that episode was great. Sean was a super humble guy, and I can't help but love listening to a guy with a South African accent talk. I can't help it. It's great.
Nah, he was awesome. I had quite a few laughs during that, and very, very humble, very gracious.
Yeah, man. Hey, there were so many things he talked about in that episode that I don't know that we've talked about in the Wrap before. But one thing I noticed was when he was talking about producers or just musicians in general who are really good at programming drums in real time. And Chris, I know you have a lot of experience programming drums now with doing all your custom songs and doing demos for Less Than Jake songs. How quick are you at programming drums now? You're probably pretty good, huh?
Well, I'm quick now because I use the Logic drummer, and now yeah, I'm learning how to fly different sounds into that, and I'm trying to expand my program drum vocabulary. But yeah, it's back in the day, it was, you know, especially 2005, it was difficult to program drums. You had to really know what you were doing. And I saw some of these guys. I mean, the guy that worked on In With the Out Crowd, he was doing some drum stuff that was just like, I was listening to some of the stuff that he was working on, Paul, unreal.
Yeah,
absolutely unreal what they could do. So I'm nowhere near the level of that, but yeah, it's definitely an art form. You have to know what you're doing.
It's cool watching a producer. I remember watching Mark McCluskey just in the grid within the programming drums so quickly, and they sounded great. You know, it's a real talent. It's a real cool thing to witness, for sure. Another thing that Sean touched on in this episode that I thought was really cool, and I know this relates to Less Than Jake and
a lot of music in general, was having that opening to a song that is instantly recognizable. Like if you were on Name That Tune, you could go, I could name that tune in two notes, you know? And I know that you have a lot of those types of songs, but this song is definitely like that too.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'll try to put it in layman's terms for those non-musicians possibly listening to the show right now, but the song's in drop D flat tuning. It's just the second fret. You just bar it with your whole finger, and the first chord is your fingers on, and then in between it, you're lifting your finger off, hitting just the open notes. And it's really easy, but it's like you said, it's instantly recognizable. It's such a fun riff to play.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you guys also touched on, which I thought was funny, the prerequisite pre-chorus, like that thought process that you have to have an intro, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, like there's this formula to songwriting that you have to follow if you want to have a hit song. To be honest, man, when I hear those songs that follow that exact whatever A B type formula, I get bored, you know. And and it's the differences from that formula that makes music interesting to me, but maybe that's just me.
Well, and Sean even said it, you know, this pre-chorus is actually like a tag on the verse. It's only 3 seconds long,
right?
But I called it a pre-chorus because that exact lyric happens before chorus one and before chorus two, so it really is a pre-chorus, but not in the traditional sense. And I think that he didn't want it to have the cookie cutter pre-chorus prerequisite. I think that maybe is why it was that short. And I think the setup's perfect for leading into the chorus.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, he talked about having something to hold on to as far as repeating the chorus or repeating lyrics in the song. And I do think that that's important. I think, you know, it's funny. First things that come to mind, man, is like recent Propagandhi albums where it's like the songs are just like a run-on sentence. It's great, but are you going to be able to sing along? That might be kind of difficult, you know? So you do need those things to sing along to. And Chris, I'm trying to think if I've experienced this, but you brought up like playing in other countries where people will sing the riff. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I mean, Europe, they'll in England, they'll sing the horn parts. They'll sing the guitar riff in Gainesville Rock City. You know, they'll actually sing that as I'm playing it. Japan does that too.
Yeah.
And it's something you don't see too much here in the States, but when it happens, it's unreal. And I can actually see people humming the riff to this either song. And he agreed. I didn't check out any live videos of this, but I can almost guarantee a European audience has done that to this song.
I haven't experienced the crowd singing like a guitar lead or anything, but I know that when we've been to Japan, we've experienced the spontaneous hey, 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 where you didn't even encourage the people to do that, yet it just happens to the beat, and you're like, whoa! I know you've experienced that a million times, Chris, but for little old me, that's a real thrill.
No, it's a rush. Every time something like that happens, it gives you the what the heck moment, and you're like, what is going on? I love that. You know, I had preconceived notions of what this song was about, and this is I'm trying to recall who it was on the show that was talking about the having aggravation with the record label, the producers, and you know, like they're stepping on my art, and Sean was pretty vocal about that. I also thought it was funny when he talked about the producer that basically lets you know before you entered the studio how many records he sold that week.
That was one of the weirdest stories. Like, I haven't experienced that. I kind of feel like if I would experience that, I'd be like, all right, I'm out of here. I don't know, man. I like humble
some of these,
people.
Yeah, some of these guys, and I've heard producers say, you know, well, how many gold records do you have on your wall? And,
jeez,
you know, that's a rough one to come back with, because I would look at them and go, well, I don't have any.
Right.
that doesn't invalidate me as a songwriter, a musician, or a human being, but it's hard to argue that point. Luckily, I haven't had maybe one or two producers like that. Most of them are in there as a team player, but you'll get some of these guys. And usually it's at the 11th hour, the witching hour. You've been working for 9 hours, and you just, you know, everyone has an idea what the bridge should be. And finally, the producer goes, it's going to be this. How many gold records you got on the wall? Sometimes it's warranted, but very, very, very few and far between.
I guess if you hired a producer and you're shelling out the cash for their, for the job that they can do, you want them to have a little bit of an attitude about how good they are. I suppose I personally prefer humble people. And I felt like Sean was very humble, especially for a band that has achieved the massive success that they have. I thought he was a very cool, humble, down-to-earth guy. That was great.
I thought he was great too. And you know, he had referenced Nirvana a lot because I was afraid to bring it up. I know that they, you know, they've gotten labeled as just Nirvana wannabes, especially for this song. But if you check out the rest of their catalog, it's not just a Nirvana ripoff or something like that. And this song, I meant it graciously. This could have fit right in somewhere on In Utero. I mean, it has that vibe of that time period and just a really good modern rock radio track.
Yeah. And I would take saying that a song sounds like it could be on In Utero as a very good compliment. You know, if you told me that, I'd be like, thanks, man. I think that's kind of what he said too. So I don't think anyone took any offense to that.
No, not at all. And you know, this band, I said it at the top of the show. I was thinking, yeah, this song probably came out 2012, you know, 2015, maybe. I was shocked. 2005. They've been around for 20 years now, this band. I don't know where the time went, but they're doing something right, man. They've been doing a 20-year career is nothing to laugh at.
Yeah, definitely one of those bands where if you weren't that familiar with them, you might be like, Seether. Yeah, I've heard of them, but I don't know. But then once you start going through the songs, you're like, yeah, I know that song. Yeah, I know that song. Yeah, I know that song. They're one of those bands for sure. And that's just a credit to their massive mainstream success, which is awesome.
And speaking of mainstream success, Chris, we can't get much more mainstream than our supporting cast VIP program.
It is the most mainstream supporting cast program there is, I would say. And hey, it's the holiday season. And one thing that people might not know, Chris, is that you can give the gift of the Krista Makes a Podcast supporting cast to anyone you know who you think might enjoy the After Party podcast or might enjoy the opportunity to be a contestant on Defeat DeMakes in the future or to get discounts on merch or just support the podcast in general. If you go to KristaMakes.com and you click on gifts at the top, you can give someone the gift that keeps on giving year round.
Absolutely. And we want to thank each and every one of you who has joined the supporting cast VIP program. It is growing by the week. Your generosity is awesome. As Chris always says, it keeps the podcast going. The podcast that you know and love keeps us motivated to want to do more. The Defeat to Makes music trivia show, we're going to have another one coming up soon, has been just so much fun putting that together. And we know from the feedback from you guys that you've been enjoying it as well. And can't say it enough. Thanks to everybody who's joined our Facebook group, the Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. We have a blast in there. And if you haven't joined, please do.
Man, we have a lot of things planned now. And just as you were talking about supporting cast, whether you're part of it or not, the interaction and support from everyone that listens does seriously get us fired up. And the plans that we have for this coming year to take this podcast to the next level are very exciting. I am very happy and fired up about the things that we have going on, Chris. And we're going to start rolling some of those things out here soon. And that's all thanks to you who is listening to this podcast right now. So thanks.
Absolutely. You know, you kind of let the proverbial cat out of the bag a little bit, Chris. I am so jazzed to start talking about all the stuff we have coming up. We can't let it out just yet, but we have so many great things at the top of next year that we cannot wait to share with you, the listeners. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have a wonderful rest of December because we are in holiday month. You're going to see a lot of crazy relatives. I try to avoid my crazy relatives as much as possible, and they try to avoid me because I'm a crazy relative to them.
Yeah, I believe that. I don't...
Right on. Well, again, thanks to each and every one of you for listening. We appreciate everyone. And I want to thank this week's guest, Mr. Sean Morgan from Seether, for sitting in with us. We'll see you next week.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freites from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.
I I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.